Any questions, please? Yeah.
This probably won't be a short preamble, so I'll have to defer to the moderator if it's too long. But we have all this information. We've had it for years. I guess basically my main question is, when is it going to make a difference? And the reason I ask that is recently we had a situation which we consistently see up here where somebody, in this case it was Bishop Fred Henry, speaking boldly about the kind of material you're saying, and children are better in traditional parent families. And then you get all this reaction from supposed experts on the other side, from grassroots ordinary Canadians writing letters to the editor and saying, what's this religious fanatic doing imposing his views when the evidence doesn't say otherwise? And sometimes I think we're talking past each other, because the other side does make its arguments to give the impression that there's a rationality behind the opposing views. For instance, instead of saying that things like suicide and HIV AIDS incidents are because of the behavior, they say it's because of discrimination. I've seen some of the supposed researchers on the other side say about outcomes for children, they'll focus on the sexual ones, and instead of arguing on the same assumptions, they basically, and I've gone into some of the material that doesn't normally come out in the news articles, and they redefine good and bad outcomes. They don't consider these researchers do not, particularly for in terms of same-sex relationships and same-sex parenting, they do not consider sexual experimentation, same-sex experimentation by children or early pregnancy as necessarily wrong the way we do. So their concept of good and bad in terms of outcomes is different, and that's not usually brought out in the mainstream media. And so people like politicians have supposedly rational research to justify what they're doing. So I'm wondering, are we stuck in this talking past each other, or at the research think tank level, are researchers actually communicating and engaging on these issues, and when is it going to actually have an impact, this research, in terms of the public policy that we want to try to get back into our society?
I think there are two things. I think, firstly, again, that I'm going to come back to my first recommendation, that it may be that the researchers are going to argue with one another ad infinitum. And really, probably what will move society in Canada powerfully is good narrative, good stories. I think those affect the heart and the public sentiment. So it may be that that's one part of the answer. You've got to engage with culture and speak to culture and capture the public's imagination. I think the second thing is, with regard to research, you have to establish criteria. What is it that we're looking for in the outcomes for our children? Now, I would say that the outcomes that I've looked at today are reasonable. We want them to do well in schooling, in education. We want them to be able to work well in the workforce, to be able to relate to their colleagues, and to perform well. We want them to be able to enter into stable relationships, presumably. I think that you would get together, and supposing you were the opposition case in this debate, I would say to you, what criteria can we agree on? What do we think are important for children? Then the second step would be to take the best, this is me speaking here, the best researchers in the world or in Canada who can do research around those criteria. That's why I mentioned Paul Amato. Paul Amato may not necessarily be a friend of Maxim Institute. He may not like what we say in a number of areas, but he is a very, very good researcher. And I think you then test that research through peer review, through, you know, other discussion. And I'm still optimistic. I think you can then reach some conclusions. Now, the question then is, can you make policymakers, MPs, listen to your conclusions? But I think it is possible, and I think it's becoming clearer. The consensus now amongst the researchers is becoming clearer on these sort of issues. But I think there are two things. One, do the research, or agree the criteria, do the research. Two, put that into a story form for the people. Yeah, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much for your talk. I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of story and narrative, and I kind of think of it as reaching people's hearts and their minds, and you need both. You need the research and the stories, and that's what I try to do as well. And the it can be a little hard for some of us to say, well, how do we, you know, I don't know anything about making a movie, or how do you talk to a pop star or something like that. The thing is, so many of the stories are already out there. I don't know much about pop music in my own country in the U.S., but I certainly know enough that to see that there are so many songs filled with poignant narratives of father loss, father absence, parental divorce. Kelly Clarkson, I think her name is, had a song in the last year or two. The video was on MTV and everywhere about her experience of her parents' divorce, and the songs from the little girl's point of view, and so is the video. And I'm not particularly sentimental, and this thing made me cry just watching it, you know. So those stories are already out there, and the research is already out there. And one of the tasks, I think, is to draw it together to help people connect the dots, because the young people know about the pain, but they don't know about the research. And they don't know that there are other possibilities, and that it doesn't have to be this way. And so just showing them the stories that they're already telling one another, and saying, there's a larger story here in this research, and let me just share a little bit with you to kind of back it up and to tell you that it doesn't have to be this way, that as a society we can make different choices, helps to open eyes, I think. I was also just curious if you could just tell us briefly about the state of the family debate in New Zealand, which I'm very curious about, and thinks we have a certain way of lining up in the U.S. In Canada, they line up a certain way. What are things like, you know, kind of briefly in New Zealand?
What do you mean by the family debate?
What's the, is same-sex marriage, for instance, controversial there, around divorce and stuff? Can people speak out about concerns about children, or is it as contentious as it is in nations that I'm more familiar with? Or
I think in New Zealand, same-sex marriage has been contentious. There's a joke in New Zealand that we're the fastest lawmakers in the West. And the reason is because we're a unicameral system. We don't have a second house that can slow things down. So our same-sex legislation went through within, I think it was 3 months, start to finish. And it was driven by a number of cabinet ministers. The very interesting thing is our political process, we have select committees, and you make submissions, oral or written submissions, to the select committee. And the idea is the select committee then makes representations back to cabinet, back to government, says, well, this is what the academics think, this is what the public think. Now, we had 6,000 submissions on same-sex marriage, which was the largest number of submissions ever on any subject. Prior to that, the greatest number had been only 2,000. 98% of the submissions were against same-sex marriage. And yet, the government put through the legislation on it. So the battle is quite raging in New Zealand. The public feel that this has been foisted onto them. And they also, I think, feel that it's perhaps more of an ideology than something which is really what the New Zealanders want. So it is a very hot subject. It's a hot debate. And one feels that if there was a change in government, the legislation would be reviewed. I can't say that for certain, but I think it's probable. Yeah.
Hi, Paul. My name's Peter Dudding from the Child Welfare League of Canada. Now, you talked about the problem in terms of having enough good longitudinal research on the kind of key determinants of well-being for children. And then in your talk, you really looked at the outcomes issue relative to the kind of comparative forms of family life. Yes. But I wonder if you could comment on the basis of what longitudinal research that we do have in terms of how children are doing in our societies.
Yeah. Sure. The research I cited, probably about 20-30% of it was longitudinal. So it's finding the same findings. But I think that the general consensus is that we would still like to see more. It will depend on which country also. Like, for example, America, they seem to be extraordinarily good at having phenomenal databases packed with information. Now, in New Zealand, we've been very poor. So that some of the research I cited was from one of our best and most respected social scientists, a guy called David Ferguson, Professor David Ferguson. Now, he's one of the few people in New Zealand who's done the longitudinal studies. I don't know the position in Canada. I suspect you're better than we are at New Zealand.
We do have a national longitudinal study on
Canada. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. I apologize for my strong accent. You talked earlier about the possibility of selection bias,
yes,
and the possibility of confounding variables.
Yes.
I just want to know if you have heard about story that try to compare married parent and unmarried parent with the same socioeconomic background,
yes,
about income and about work and about the education, for instance. Have you heard about such stories? And is the gap still that big between both kind of families?
Yeah, again, there is a dearth of research in the area, and that's why I made that appeal. And that's why I was being upfront with you. At Maxim, we looked at this stuff, and we felt this is great, but we do need to see that the selection issue is covered off on. There are, I think, one or two good studies on it, but we don't think that they're substantive enough or wide enough. If I was a policy analyst and if I had power to commission more research and a good budget, that's where I'd go for refinement.
Can I just add something? Sorry.
Yeah.
My understanding of research from where I sit is that selection effects are an issue, that yes, people do select into marriage because they already have some of these characteristics, positive characteristics, but that marriage itself also confers additional benefits.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
In the selection or in the marriage itself, it's both. So even when very large longitudinal studies control for income and race and educational level and other issues like that, the outcomes for children on average are still better in married parents.
That's why it's fascinating when you look at cohabiting couples, because we know that when cohabiting couples marry, the outcomes for children get better immediately.
Can I just ask one follow-up question to what was previous people asked? Because of people like Kent, principio or presuppositional bias against trying to argue that it's marriage rather than these other things? Because when you start talking about marriage as the itself as a beneficial thing, then you're getting into sort of more intangibles like commitment. And how does the concept of commitment impact on the security of children and help them in terms of their early development, develop whatever character they need to produce these better outcomes? So is there not a presuppositional bias that we have to get over and work extra hard at in terms of showing more that it's the marriage and not these other things like better education and more books in the house that are actually producing these better outcomes for the children in married families?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. Forgive me if I'm being slow, maybe slightly tired. But I think at the beginning of the paper I defined marriage, and if it means accepting that there are certain presuppositions there as between a man and a woman, monogamous, etc., then possibly. Forgive me if I haven't quite grasped your question.
I guess I'm just thinking in terms of a philosophical context that we might be living in where people want more tangibles. I guess when we're talking about things like commitment, we're saying, is it marriage itself? Well, I think for us, we have to break that down as well, and we do try to break that down. It relates to issues like commitment, but those tend to be a little bit more intangible than some of these other characteristics. So I'm thinking in order to be able to communicate to people who don't agree with us and to compel people and show people that there's evidence and that it's not just the books in the house and it's not just the prior educational level that the married couple has reached, but that there's something about marriage itself. We have to turn that into tangibles that people understand. And if more and more people in our society only look at materialistic criteria, then there's a bit of a challenge in terms of getting that message across. So I guess I'm asking a question related to communication and how do we communicate what would probably be our position, that marriage itself has some kind of a practical benefit to the outcomes of children.
I'm still somewhat clear.
Perhaps if I can understand your question, do the benefits of marriage go across the income levels, educational levels?
Yes.
Do they?
Yes.
Hi. I was wondering, I work in the realm of theory and research, and I just wondered if you could comment for counselors on the ground, how does it help, and perhaps you can answer with a yes or no, does it help if they know that a married parent, biological family, would have prevented a teenage pregnancy, but they have a girl in their office right there in front of them who they are counseling?
Yeah. I'm not sure if we can say that they would have prevented. I think we can talk about likely outcomes. It's more likely. But in terms of the human factor, your compassion is required at that time for that girl in that office. And that is I don't know what you can do with that. If that is a reality, then that is the reality at that time.
That's why I put it in the context that it could be a yes, no question. Perhaps the research at that moment does nothing.
Yeah, it does nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Is there solid evidence that children in same-sex arrangements have very negative outcomes? So which researchers do we go to for that type of information? I've seen some. They're very small studies. I've had to defend marriage, and I've used some of those studies. But are there some solid, is there a solid material out there that we can use?
I think my colleagues may have different answers to me. My reaction is that it isn't there yet. It's not substantive. It's not wide. There's not wide enough evidence. But my colleagues may disagree with me.
The data that I've seen, and this isn't an endorsement, this is an observation, show no evidence of adverse effects of same-sex, loving couples raising children, either in the quality of their parenting or in the nature of their children's development. Now, from the standpoint of large-scale national studies of tens of thousands, we don't have that evidence. So we're really talking about studies of convenience, opportunistic studies, which is how all this research starts in its first phase. So I think that's a fair reading of where the data are today. I wanted to had a question for you. You started, interestingly, by grounding the presentation in philosophy,
yeah.
Rousseau and Kant.
Yeah.
You didn't point out that Rousseau, in some ways, realized, his autonomous life consequences in his own life. I mean, the guy was a womanizer and a neglecter of many children.
You should elaborate on that.
What?
Elaborate on that last point.
I don't think I can go beyond that because I know when I finally read about that, I was surprised.
He had a number of children. As soon as they were born, they were just thrust into orphanages. Oh. And five. And
that we know about.
A number of them died. Well, did any live?
We don't know whatever happened. We don't know what.
But it was his basic position was that parents and authority figures are a negative influence on the child, and that the child needs to be allowed to grow in its own way,
born free. My question is this: if in fact the things that concern you, and this is not an attempt to be critical, it's really for dialogue, stem from that real renaissance in the view of the nature of man to society, the nature of man to existence, etc. In fact, some might argue it is at the core of what goes by the name of the clash of civilizations, what fundamental traditional Muslim or even religions are all about is not catching the cultural disease of the West, in which connections are secondary to autonomous pursuits. So I guess my question goes like this. Given that philosophic and now deeply embedded cultural fabric, are we pushing on a string here?
No.
And does one need a fundamental Kant or Rousseau to come along and articulate a much more connectivist and embeddedness philosophy that not only takes, but that we appreciate takes time to take.
Sure. I think there probably is a need for another Kant or Rousseau. I prefer the Kant, to perhaps undo the damage that might have been done. But I want to say that, you know, I went after the autonomy, the rational individual, etc. There are obviously huge strengths to that. On the positive side, we wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Rousseau and Kant. And I perhaps should have acknowledged the positive impact that they've had in Western culture, which I think has been absolutely enormous.